This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 109 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we this hot summer night?
We're doing well, David. Good to be talking with you again.
Yep, it looks like we're going to have a good evening. We've got, we're going to go with our guest format instead of our news format. We'll have some news in it, but why don't you introduce our guest?
My pleasure. Joining us this episode is Dr. Ella Atkins. She's an associate professor in the Department of Aerospace Engineering at the University of Michigan, where she's director of the Autonomous Aerospace Systems Lab. Now, we'll put her full bio in the show notes at uavdigest.com/109. But briefly, Dr. Atkins received her bachelor's and master's degrees in aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. She also went on then to University of Michigan, where she earned her master's and PhD in computer science and engineering. Now, Dr. Atkins, who we will be calling Ella from this point forward, I think she's a member of the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. She's a member of the Intelligent Systems Technical Committee. She's also associate editor of the Journal of Aerospace Information Systems. She's a member of IEEE, AOPA, of course, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, and the AMA. She's also UAS volume editor for the Encyclopedia of Aerospace Engineering. And Ella, do I understand correctly that you're also a private pilot?
I am a private pilot. I also own a small public grass strip airport in Michigan.
So even though you've got this strong focus on unmanned aircraft, you are sort of solidly grounded as well with the manned aircraft perspective.
I think flying is cool whether you're in the airplane or not.
All right. Perfect. Perfect. Well, David, what do you think?
I have one thing in common with her. I'm a member of AMA. But other than that, I'm really looking forward to our conversation tonight. And it always helps, Ella, to have the pilot bona fides hidden in the background, because then people say, well, they don't understand what a real pilot does. And so I'm really happy about that. But we better get started, because this half hour is going to run really quickly.
Yeah, it sure is.
So where would you like to start? Should we start talk about the University of Michigan and tell us what the Autonomous Aerospace Systems Lab is?
Sure. That's the title of my lab. A lot of us faculty in aerospace engineering and other departments are given a small space where we conduct our research activities, and we get to name them ourselves. So I combined autonomous and aerospace and systems together. The focus is on mostly small unmanned aircraft, not so much the design of a novel structure or new aerodynamic shape, but more in terms of the sensors, the data processing, and the decision-making that's done on board that will ultimately, hopefully, make aircraft both safer and more capable. I say aircraft because although most of the work that we do that's experimental is with unmanned aircraft, a lot of the solutions would apply to either manned or unmanned.
Let's jump into a conversation about some of the sort of the main topics that we've been covering when it comes to unmanned aircraft systems. And one of those is privacy. Do we really need separate regulations that deal strictly with UAS privacy? What are your thoughts on that, Ella?
So I think it's a hard question because the FAA has never been asked to do anything really about privacy. They have been focused on helping pilots navigate the skies more safely by having better navigation aids, air traffic control, etc. And now that we have unmanned aircraft, they're very much concerned about making sure they're safe in terms of not hitting other aircraft or crashing over populous areas, for example. Privacy is a very different question. If you have an unmanned aircraft that doesn't even have a camera on it, is it really capable of invading privacy? Sure, it's capable of making noise. It's capable of posing risk or hazard. But it's not really ever going to be capable of being used to take a picture or video of someone in their backyard in a compromising situation. The other thing to think about is we have satellites, the same satellites that give us a lot of the data that's shown on Google Earth. We have manned aircraft that are flying at slightly higher altitudes, and then other unmanned aircraft flying very high. With modern technology that provides high-resolution images from long distances, it's not clear that everyone should be so laser-focused on the small unmanned aircraft. The thing that they have is they have the ability to annoy us and get in our face, which is not just about privacy. In terms of laws, a lot of the low-flying drones, so the so-called drones, are going to ultimately be subject to ground-based laws such as disorderly conduct, which sometimes includes the peeping Tom laws that would involve not invading privacy. Trespassing laws might also apply, especially to that low-altitude layer of airspace that's really within immediate reach of the ground.
So one of the discussions Max and I have had is we always question whether when there's an incident, immediately the local state law enforcement, the state legislatures, they start wanting to regulate the use of drones and the use of cameras. And you're not allowed to fly your drone over that public park because you're going to be spying on people. And we're always saying, but if you're doing that, you're already violating some laws on the ground. So you're of the agreement that we don't necessarily need to have specific laws. We can use it. We just need to enforce the ones that are already in existence. Then would you agree?
Yes. And I think that ultimately both the laws and the enforcement mechanisms will rise up from the ground for these low altitude drones. They won't come down from the high altitude sky because it's just not practical for the FAA to enforce that kind of law, but instead it's much more practical for local law enforcement and so forth to enforce those sorts of laws.
Yeah, so I think we're kind of in agreement on this because my position has always been we don't need additional laws for privacy because privacy is privacy regardless of the technology that's, you know, that might be used to invade it. It's the invasion of privacy that should be the focus of laws or regulation. So I think we're all in violent agreement.
Sounds like it. That's great.
Now, another area that's been kind of confusing is who has the legal right to enforce the airspace? Is it the FAA? Is it the states, local communities, even landowners? You know, all of these elements, all of these stakeholders have different viewpoints. And certainly we don't want to get into a situation where, you know, we're getting laws and regulations coming from multiple sources. That there has to be some sort of rationality to all that. Ella, what do you think is the way to view this in a way that makes sense sort of long term?
Well, so if you look to the past where manned aviation was dominant, whether it's helicopters, general aviation, commercial transport, we had a very nice structure for the airspace, the different classes of airspace, the kind of inverted wedding cake picture of the sky that makes sure that there's a lot of communication and so forth around major airports, but then pretty much free flight in the Class G airspace, which is the so-called uncontrolled airspace. The problem is when many years ago, federal government created a document that said that the national airspace system was basically taken for public transit purposes, no one was thinking about this really low altitude airspace layer that connects the sky and the ground.
Sure.
Now what we're really struggling with is we kind of wake up and we say, you know, the small unmanned aircraft, that's exactly where they're going to be. They're not going to be up at several thousand feet. It's not practical if you're going to fly for a kilometer or just over a local field to go up that high and have to come back down. It makes a lot more sense to just be very close to the ground. So the question then is, who owns and controls that airspace? There is precedent that's been set by the Supreme Court in kind of an opposite sense. A chicken farmer named Cosby claimed that low-flying manned aircraft were disturbing his chickens and they were throwing their bodies against the chicken house and killing themselves. No kidding. This is from 1946. And in that particular case, the Supreme Court was very clear that the landowner, in this case Cosby, had the both ownership and control of what they called immediate reaches airspace. That's why I'm using that term when we talk. That layer was never defined in terms of a particular number, but that number wasn't zero, meaning how far above ground level, AGL altitude, is considered immediate reaches, which is exclusively owned and controlled by the landowner. We now have a situation where the FAA, Jim Williams in particular, before he retired, was very clear that his interpretation was that because our backyards can be safely navigated by small handheld drones, that the FAA was considering the airspace down to the blade of grass below the top of the house, below the top of the trees, to be part of the national airspace system.
Right.
To me, this is very troubling because it basically is in direct contradiction with this United States versus Cosby Supreme Court case. Somebody has to push on this because otherwise we're going to end up with continued what I'll call chaos, where law enforcement, firefighters, and so forth are not quite so sure what they can do when things happen, like drones fly over wildfires and interfere with firefighting and so forth. Yet we have this thought that somehow that's navigable airspace. And to me, it just doesn't make sense that even though we can fly a small handheld drone in our backyards, that that's really part of the national airspace system that has been taken as a necessity for public transit.
You know, Max, she just said fly our drones in our backyard. She hasn't seen either one of us pilot, has she?
You mean crash them in our backyard?
That would be more appropriate. Well, yeah, in my case, it's the living room.
Right.
But go ahead. I didn't mean to stomp on your question.
No, I was just going to say that also as a practical matter, if the FAA thinks that they need to regulate the airspace all the way down to the blade of grass, it's not practical. I mean, if my neighbor is flying his drone in his backyard and that's driving the dog of the neighbor on the other side nuts so that the barking is incessant and it's waking up other neighbors in the middle of the night, the FAA is not going to get involved in that.
Right. I mean, we've kind of lost touch with the notion of the community itself working things out. In the case that you talk about with the dog and the neighbor and the drone and so on, you shake hands with your neighbor and work things out. You know, one example that I have is, let's say that my son, who's somewhat lacking in caution, goes out and launches something that is a toy and, you know, it's not very safe. Well, it's my responsibility as a parent to go running out of the house and stopping my kid. It's not the responsibility of me to somehow call the local air traffic controller and say,
yeah,
my son is flying a drone in your airspace. What should we do?
Right.
Well, what? Okay. Then Ella, let's talk a little bit more about this scenario where the neighbors are taking matters in their own hands. Like, unfortunately, today we've got someone sent us a link to a armament company that now is making buckshot for anti-drones. So we've gone from the opposite extreme of when Max and I first started the show, that everybody seemed drones were predators and reapers frying hellfires, to now we have people pulling out their shotguns and shooting their neighbor's drones out of the sky with buckshot. How do we get this kind of stuff under control?
Well, so I think that one of the challenges is that it's unlikely that one size fits all. If someone owns a substantial tract of property privately, they should be able to make the decisions on what flies at low altitude over that property. They're the only ones that will care. That would really satisfy a lot of the concerns for agriculture, pipeline, power line inspection, where the power line is in a rural area, not necessarily going through a neighborhood. So then we start talking about suburban and urban applications. And the reality is, if you think about a community in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, I'm from Michigan, of course, versus a community in a town in New Jersey that's a suburb of Manhattan, it's unlikely that the solutions should be the same. There should be some feedback from the community. And for example, if the state of Texas or a city in Texas wants to authorize people to pull out their shotguns and shoot their neighbor's drones down if they're annoying them, then okay, well, I've made jokes before that drones can be a form of challenging skeet. this was back in the context of Deer Creek, Colorado.
Hmm.
To some extent, the reason that local governments exist is because there are differences between the different communities. So shouldn't it be the case that a community could set aside a piece of land as a drone park? Then people who get drones as toys and just want to have a good time, perhaps you guys who have maybe some trouble in your backyard, could go out to a larger field where everybody in the community knew that there were going to be drones. And if you don't like those drones, you go to a different park. Right now, that's not really something we can do as easily, especially if some of the operators there are not just hobbyists, but they want to try out other things. Mm. And so we need to get to a point where the communities and the private landowners and public landowners and states also have the jurisdiction to bring their preferences that are associated with their communities and the land up to this immediate reaches airspace. And then will it be perfect? No. I mean, we'll have the same kind of fights in community government that we have over a whole bunch of other things that are already on the ground, right? But that process has been working reasonably well. There are compromises, and in a democracy, we like to think that the majority carries the decision. And so if a community wants to support drones, they'll figure out how to do that. And if the community doesn't want them overall, then they should have the right to say no.
Well, it seems that a lot of states in the U.S. Have assumed that they have the authority to do that. I mean, we see in the statistics reported in the from the National Conference of State Legislatures that in 2015 alone, this year, 45 states have considered 156 bills that were in some way related to drones or unmanned aircraft. Many states, maybe half the states in the U.S., have enacted drone laws, and others are considering them. So the states are taking action. They're not waiting for anyone to tell them that they do or do not have the authority.
Right. And I think that's an appropriate step because, again, it does allow the states to express in their own legislation what that particular area of the country feels is an appropriate step forward. I think part of the danger is that we need better education. If you go back 100 years, I remember my grandmother never quite learned to drive a car, and she, in fact, was not really all that comfortable riding around in a car because they were kind of scary and dangerous. She grew up at a time where cars were first coming out, and that was a different time. People trusted horses more. Are we at a time right now where the drones really haven't been out for so long that we understand them? They're not really part of our culture yet. So unless you're actually in the field, you're not really so comfortable with them that they're just a part of what you do. Now, maybe that should scare people, because that does have the connotation that they'll become more commonplace as time goes on. Yet that doesn't mean that they have to be feared or dangerous or equipped with cameras that invade our privacy. It just means that we need to resolve this kind of startup transience, so to speak, that we're going through right now as we get the technology out and use it.
You know, that's very interesting, Ella, because we tend to think about the issues surrounding integration of drones into the national airspace, but maybe the bigger issue is integration of just the concept of drones into the culture.
I think that's a big deal, and I think we're seeing kind of the bipolar response right now, where some people are so enthusiastic about them that they go out and they do things without thought that are really not very safe. And then other people want to shoot them down because they think they're so terrible.
Right.
So from your perspective, how can we start educating the masses? I mean, anytime there's an issue, now my day job is completely different than what we're doing tonight for the show. But if there's a drone issue or that happens by an airport or something, I'm always the resource that everybody in the office comes from the general public, and they're like, well, why would they do this? And unfortunately, I kind of always say I can't fix stupid, but how do we educate, or do you have suggestions on how can we keep building a better reputation, which is the goal Max and I set out with when we started this show, for UAVs, when there's every day you get another news that another airline almost was hit by a UAV being flown at the end of the runway. I mean, how do we educate either the general public or the people who are going out and doing this, not purposely, but inadvertently?
So I think the anarchy that we're seeing is largely the hobbyists. It would be very surprising to hear that a sanctioned university or corporate flight was involved in these kind of very bad behaviors where a drone goes up and buzzes a jet on final approach to a runway. I think these are people who are just lacking information and rules. The reality is we need common sense rules at whatever government level they manage to get through. Because right now we tell people, don't fly in these places, but we don't tell them where they should fly. They need to have guidance. It's not like everybody just wants to break the rules, but if you don't tell them what to do, they don't know. So really, the safety culture will, I think, require the people who build the drones, the commercial operators, and just the regular people. And let me classify them as adult hobbyists and hobbyist minor parents. Now, what do I mean by that? We're responsible as parents. I'm a parent with three minor kids. We're responsible for seeing what they do, and we're responsible for knowing enough about what's safe and what's not to kind of need to supervise if somebody does something irresponsible. The adult hobbyists, I think if we really kind of put stuff out there for a while, it's not going to happen in 24 hours, but over the course of a couple of years, they'll eventually figure out that there is a little bit of responsibility. Another thing that the manufacturers have started to do is to make no-fly zones geofenced out in the software, so that if you're flying, say, a DJI Phantom and you tell it to fly over the White House lawn, once it gets close to the White House lawn, it'll just shut its motors off and fall down. Now, maybe that's not the very best solution. It's a simple solution, but at least would prevent that vehicle from flying into the White House lawn, even if the operator was telling it that was the right thing to do. I believe that some of the manufacturers are working with the FAA and the international civil aviation folks to do the same type of geofencing to keep out drones from airport traffic areas. So if that's successful, then at least will be a lot harder for somebody to convince their drone to fly in those areas. So that's a positive thing that the manufacturers can do. You know, we can focus on creating the so-called drone parks to give people a place to fly. And we can basically keep trying to figure out what people want and what they don't want in terms of these operations. You can't just go out and fly everywhere. I don't think right now people really recognize that without landowner permission, they really shouldn't be going out and buzzing the ground. But you know what? Our federal government is feeding that belief by saying that the landowner has no ownership or control of their airspace.
Right. It's kind of ironic almost in a way.
Yeah. I mean, that needs to stop. That needs to be turned around so that it is extremely clear to everyone that they can't just go over somebody else's backyard, because that is, in fact, the airspace that is part of that property.
Ella, I do like one of the things you said is, we've spent so much time telling people where not to fly. We need to start showing people where they can safely fly. I mean, that's very profound. It's kind of a different perspective that, you know, like the drone racing leagues now that are showing up that are going to give people an outlet. I've always said that we need a drone equivalent of the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the AMA, and where people as hobbyists could go, you know, as a start. And, you know, I got a drone for Christmas. You know, when I worked at a hobby shop when I was a kid, my first job was working at a hobby shop. When we sold someone a radio controlled airplane, we also gave them the information to the AMA, you know, and they're like, well, why do I need this? I said, well, A, you'll find people to help teach you to fly. B, you'll get some insurance should you fly your airplane into your neighbor's house. And C, it's overall good practice that you won't be wasting your money crashing your aircraft on the first flight, because there'll be people who will help you. So I think we really need to start working on trying to get a community developed of hobbyists to provide a welcoming space for this technology. I don't know how you start that, but that's a very profound thing. Instead of telling everyone, well, you can't fly there, you can't fly there, you can't fly there, etc.
Yeah, no, I think AMA is trying to help and draw people into their organization, even if they have multicopters that, as I've told many people, no longer require a skill or knowledge to get up in the sky. I mean, I think that's a big difference from what we see today and a long time ago, is that with the sophisticated autopilots that these things come with, you're not going to just go out and crash it 2 seconds after you put it up in the air, because it's basically going to fly itself if you give it a waypoint. And so that means that people don't learn these lessons about safety, because they're basically novices and stay that way well into where they have the thing up too high or too close to an airport or whatever. But, you know, I think there is let me put in a plug for the Know Before You Fly website, which AMA and others have put together to at least provide some common sense guidelines for hobbyists.
Yes.
We've endorsed that several times, and it was well-timed coming out this holiday. Hopefully, they will reinforce it as we get closer to the holiday season here in the States with Christmas coming up, that we get put that on the front end, not just immediately after the holiday.
Yeah, so I see, there are a lot of people have said, well, let's put the equivalent of license plates on drones or some kind of registration marking that makes it clear who owns the vehicle. I think if the drone is flying over any public property or over anyone else's property that they might not have gotten explicit permission from, that's a great idea. I did want to put in my thought. I've been in the recent months putting on what I'll call my farm hat. I grew up on a farm in West Virginia. And one of the things that's a little scary about that notion is, you know, I remember driving a tractor when I was quite young. And I'm pretty sure that tractor is not something that would be considered the ground-based equivalent of airworthy. But it wasn't the job of a federal or state organization to decide whether the 50-year-old tractor should be out in use, because the reality is, to make money on a small farm, you needed the ability to do that kind of thing without having inspectors coming in all the time, which ultimately cost money. So I think we have to be a little bit careful, especially when we try to get these drones into the hands of property owners and so forth for tasks that will really kind of help them, but they won't be able to use them if it costs too much money. we don't want to just go out there and regulate to death the vehicles and the requirements for people who fly them, like being licensed pilot and so on.
Well, I think we're going to run a little bit long this episode, but I think it's worthwhile because I think we're having a really good conversation, a really healthy conversation. Let's just touch really quickly on the issue of managing the airspace. We've seen some proposals from Google and Amazon lately, a little bit different, but we've talked about those. And what do you think, Ella, about the approach that Google and Amazon have been offering up?
So I'm really encouraged that they have spent so much time and money in terms of people working with the FAA and others in government to try to find a solution for this kind of low-altitude unmanned aircraft airspace and traffic management protocols. I recently went to a conference called UTM, UAS Traffic Management, at NASA Ames in California.
Yes.
NASA is getting involved in this as well, where what they view their role is trying to figure out how to use data links, access to databases and so forth to help these kind of low-altitude vehicles talk to each other and coordinate data, including flight plans, weather, and other information in a way that makes sense for small unmanned aircraft, which might be a little bit different than what we typically see for the Cessnas and the Airbus and Boeing jets. So it was really exciting to see all of that. And, you know, it really Google and Amazon are putting effort into helping see that through as well. I think one of the things that I may have a little disagreement with was there was the kind of spokesperson, the leader of the Amazon Prime Air group, who showed a very nice picture of layered airspace from 0 to 400 feet that showed a concept where in the 0 to 200 layer feet, you'd have slow flying unmanned aircraft that were, you know, on approach and departure and flying locally in communities. And then between 2 and 400 feet, you had the higher speed transit for the unmanned aircraft. Now, and then between 4 and 500 feet, you basically had a buffer to separate them from manned aircraft. And then, of course, they notched out around major airports and so forth. The problem that I have with that really circles back to this notion of immediate reaches airspace. In that particular vision, there is no place for that immediate reaches landowner owned and controlled airspace layer because that vision goes all the way down to zero.
And that's a problem. I mean, I've said this before. I could just imagine, a parade of package carrying drones flying over my property or down my street. And I mean, these are not particularly quiet devices, and that could be an issue.
Right. So I think there are some questions in what do you do? You know, maybe the easiest thing to do with that kind of cartoon picture is to move it up. Right. Instead of 0 to 200 and 2 to 400, maybe you put the lowest 200 or 300 as this immediate reaches airspace where the laws of the land reach up to the sky. And then you have their slow airspace at maybe, you know, 200 or 300 to 400 or 500. And then another 200 on top of that is the high speed transit. Now, that won't sit well with probably many people that are listening to this who are manned aircraft pilots.
Yes.
Because that pushes this layer of unmanned aircraft traffic above 500 feet. But in reality, you know, maybe I'm a little bit too risk averse, having had some personal experience with friends who didn't fare too well in general aviation aircraft. But, you know, I kind of look at that and I'm like, well, what's magic about 500 feet? I don't think I've ever read a safety analysis of any sort that said that a plane is really safe to fly at 500 feet, but is not safe to fly at 450. So maybe in this day and age of us wanting to separate the drones from the manned aircraft a little bit, maybe if the manned aircraft are asked to stay above 600, it's not the end of the world. Of course, there could be clearances for both the drones to move up and the manned to move down. Mm-hmm. But if you basically have that layer, you know, Amazon's and others' vision of having a drone-dominated airspace layer that's not normally occupied by manned aircraft, if it goes up just 100 feet above where general aviation is supposed to stay over rural areas right now. I guess I don't see that that's a giant controversy that should be a showstopper.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. It's an arbitrary altitude, at least as far as I know. And so we treat it as something that's not to be violated or changed. But, you know, why not? Why don't we question that? And since we kind of need the layers, if we take that layered approach, maybe it's time to reevaluate that 500-foot altitude level. Very fascinating.
Right. And I'm not suggesting that it be 1,000 or 2,000 or something ridiculously yeah. higher. Just a little nudge that keeps the noisy drones a certain distance away from the ground, but yet lets them have corridors to transit where they're not going to be mixing with manned aircraft.
Hmm. Well, all right. We could certainly spend some more time talking about that as well as some other topics, but I think we should spend a few minutes and just look at the University of Michigan and the programs that are available for education in unmanned aircraft. We certainly have a lot of listeners who are interested in learning, interested in education, interested in training of various sorts. And we've seen a lot of drone schools pop up. And we have university programs like the University of Michigan. We've talked with our friends at Embry-Riddle about some of the things that they're doing. But tell us, Ella, about some of the programs at the University of Michigan and what kinds of prospective students should be attracted to those programs.
Sure. I think we're a pretty classic academic institution that has a really strong College of Engineering that's very broad and very large, as well as many other colleges ranging from great medical school and humanities, arts, architecture, music, et cetera. The list of majors is quite large. You know, if you had talked to me 10 years ago, I would have said that all the unmanned aircraft activity would have been in the College of Engineering, where we have really good aerospace, computer science. We have a brand new robotics master's and PhD programs that are going to give people kind of more interdisciplinary experience. Any of those would have a lot of opportunities for unmanned aircraft. In aerospace, you tend to think of novel vehicle design, motors, propellers, but also sensors and dynamics control and the software that goes along with that. That's the classic place that you would kind of have new widgets that fly coming out of. But we also have, like in computer science, there are a lot of people worried about cybersecurity, communications, software validation, verification. These are critical if we're going to have any sort of level of autonomy. And then in robotics, we have a lot of interdisciplinary studies that involve all of those things, people working together to make a secure, capable, autonomous or semi-autonomous flying vehicle that is somehow cutting edge above and beyond what's off the shelf today. And I think people ranging from high school seniors that would be interested in these opportunities all the way through people interested in a PhD would be very welcome at Michigan, and we're going to have a lot of unmanned aircraft activities to come in the future. One of the things that we are seeing right now is that a lot of non-engineering programs are using unmanned aircraft, ranging from, people maybe more controversial are journalists, right? Because they want to be out over events that are happening, but they might interfere very easily. So that's actually a challenge problem that crosses over not only the technology, but also the proper operational protocol. So there are some nice opportunities for interdisciplinary research at universities, not so much in how do you get the big story and write about it, as in what kind of operations would you see in the future that would allow freedom of the press and safety of the public and ability of law enforcement, firefighters, and so forth to get the job done to all be successful together.
Right, right. Integrating unmanned aircraft as a tool into other disciplines.
Right, but you heard what I said there. There, the challenge is not so much in sensing and avoiding other aircraft as it is in integrating the small unmanned aircraft with the entities on the ground.
Yes. All right, and where can people go online to find out more about University of Michigan programs?
Well, there's tons of websites. If you type University of Michigan, you'll see main sites. So the College of Engineering has a website, engine.umich.edu. Let Me Advertise Robotics, which I'm a big part of, and it's very exciting, robotics.umich.edu. And then aerospace and other departments. It's a simple typing into the Google search window, and you can find the main pages. Almost all of our websites have links to major projects, requirements for the different degree programs, faculty pages, student teams, and so forth as well.
Okay, very good. Well, David, what do you think?
I think it's been a fantastic conversation. Hopefully, Ella, you'll come back and keep us posted on what's going on. You've got some wonderful perspectives and, if I might say, very level-headed, well thought out, you know, both positive and positive to move forward with all these challenges that we set out to try to bring to light, and we got to keep working on it. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I look forward to coming back.
All right, David, we're going to put a lot of material in the show notes, some of the things that we specifically talked about and some other supporting material that we pulled together on these topics. So we invite everybody to take a look at the show notes at the uavdigest.com/109 for episode 109. David, what else do you think we need to do before we close this out?
Oh, I think we're running long, so I think we just basically should close out the show and thank our guests. And you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook at UAV Digest. And of course, if you want to help the show, there's multiple ways you can do it. You could buy some merch through our Cafe Press store. You can leave a review on iTunes. That's a huge help. Take 5 minutes and leave a review and so that other people can find us. And we can bring additional guests like Ella for you guys to hear. And last but not least, if you'd like to financially help us, you can go to our Patreon account and become a patron of the show. So I guess with that, Max, we should wrap this up until next week. So I'm David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.